It was a year ago, believe it or not, at the San Jose Mercury News. Ran a series of stories called The Dark Alliance by Gary Webb. I'm sure everyone here is familiar with them. What was revealed in those articles was the fact that there was a direct link between several narcotics organizations run by Norwin Meneses, Oscar Danilo Blandon, and Freeway Ricky Ross here in South Central Los Angeles. And there was also a link between those drug organizations, direct, and the Central Intelligence Agency, and support for the Cold War effort. It created a big stink, but it was not at all the first time these stories have ever been made public. It was not the first time that we had ever heard anything about CIA dealing drugs, not by a long shot. What was unique about the Gary Webb stories was that for the first time, there was a face put on the suffering connected to CIA drug dealing. Abraham Lincoln said that the one lady who started the Civil War was Harriet Beecher Stowe, because she wrote a book called Uncle Tom's Cabin. And everybody could read that book and know what it felt like to be a slave. From where I sit, the Gary Webb stories perform much the same functions. For the first time in the history of revelations about CIA drug dealing, there was a direct connection between CIA involvement in drug trafficking and crack babies in South Central, and drive-by shootings, and gangs, and the sufferings caused to families, and the users, and the addicts, and all the people who were enslaved by crack cocaine. Now, it was 8 months ago that there was a town hall meeting down at Locke High School in Watts, chaired by Juanita Millender McDonald, not Maxine Waters. She's a representative from Compton. And I had been at one prior meeting before that at Compton College, and I stood up there. But at Locke High School, where Director John Deutsch was meeting with the people in an unprecedented move, I stood up and confronted him directly and said, I am a former LAPD narcotics detective. I work South Central, and I can tell you, Director Deutsch, emphatically and without equivocation, that the agency has been dealing drugs in this country for a long time. And I think many of you probably remembered that. We got news all over the place with that one. I have to tell you, that will remain probably one of the most fun experiences of my whole life. I met Dick Gregory for the first time in February of this year when Crack the CIA Coalition held its rally in downtown Los Angeles. We had 4,000 people show up. And Dick pulled me aside and said that he had gotten word out of the White House, out of the Justice Department, out of various government agencies. And my confrontation of Deutsch had cost him his appointment as Secretary of Defense. He had been a shooter. Because I named in that confrontation, for those of you who saw it, three specific agency operations known as Amadeus, Pegasus, and Watchtower. We will talk about those a little bit later. Now, what's happened as time has gone on is we had this fervor for a while, and as probably you're all aware, it's like, where did the story go? Well, the San Jose apparently corrected, didn't retract, but they corrected some stories. Gary Webb is now driving 150 miles one way to work in Cupertino. He's covering dog shows and weddings and family events. Okay, and what happened to Gary Webb, one of my favorite heroes in all of this stuff about what CIA does and conspiracies is a man by the name of Fletcher Prouty. Everybody here see JFK by Oliver Stone, the movie? Mm-hmm. Remember the man, Mr. X, sitting on the bench who was talking to Jim Garrison? That was Fletcher Prouty, who's written several books. He was a full colonel inside the Pentagon Special Operations Division. And Gary Webb was what Fletcher calls an object lesson. The archetypal object lesson, according to Fletcher Prouty, is Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson was riding three cars behind John F. Kennedy. The bullets that killed him went directly over Lyndon Johnson's head. And Lyndon Johnson spent the rest of his life, and certainly his tenure as president, knowing that those bullets could have been just as easily directed at him. Gary Webb has become an object lesson. Any reporter who now may want to take on this story can look to Gary Webb, who should have gotten the Pulitzer Prize, and say he's now driving 150 miles one way to work in Cupertino covering dog stories. Get the point? There are many witnesses in this waiting to testify, and there may well be hearings, and I'm going to give you some of the current newsy stuff before I go into my material.
Michael, forgive me. We all thought Kennedy was shot from the front, not from behind.
Well, bullets went from all directions, but yes, he was shot from the front, of course. Okay, but Johnson was in that motorcade, and he was accessible to the same rifles. That's the point I was trying to make. I wasn't disparaging anything else, and I wasn't certainly saying that Oswald did it. There are many other witnesses to CIA drug dealing who want to testify, who are able to testify, and there is a mountain of evidence admissible under legal standards in a court of law to prove that CIA has been dealing drugs for a long time. In a court of law, I know we have one attorney in the room. In a court of law, one of the strongest forms of direct testimony is eyewitness testimony. Now, I was a cop, and I worked assignments both in detectives and in patrol. One of the first things a cop says when he gets to a crime scene is, did anybody see it? Are there any witnesses? Eyewitness testimony is direct evidence, admissible. I am an eyewitness to CIA drug dealing. So is my very good friend Celerino Castillo, a former DEA agent who was president of Ilopango, an air base in El Salvador, run by the National Security Council and CIA, who witnessed planes being loaded with cocaine, who was confronted by U.S. Ambassador Edwin Corr and told, stop writing reports, stop pressing for a prosecution, it's a White House operation, leave it alone. That's admissible evidence. Oliver North's diary, July 12, 1985, quote, without the Honduran military, there would have been no Contras. $14 million to buy arms, and there were a bunch of other words in there, but paraphrased arms, but continuing the quote, came from drugs, end quote. That's evidence. There's a mountain of evidence, and you're going to see some of that tonight. We're waiting to testify. The heat's being turned up, whether you see it in the newspapers or not. The Central Intelligence Agency and the Department of Justice Inspector Generals, Frederick Hitz for CIA and Mike Bromwich for Department of Justice, are compelled and have committed to come back with their investigative reports, their findings on whether CIA was involved in drug dealing sometime this fall. We're talking September or October. That is not far away. At that time, there will be hearings. Now, I've spoken within the last month to the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, and I asked them, well, what's going to determine whether these are real hearings or just like some of the sham political theater that we've seen before? Al Cummings, a senior investigator, said, the scope of the hearings will be determined by A, what Maxine Waters does, B, the credibility of the reports from the Inspector General's office, and C, public reaction. And I said, what's going to determine the credibility of the reports? He said, C, item C, public reaction. If there is no outcry, there will be no hearings when they come back and tell us there's no evidence. Okay? That's what they're preparing for. Now, the pressure is really being turned up on the witnesses. I was burglarized 2 weeks ago. They got my address book, all my phone numbers, all my sources. I have most of it copied. But they also got a complete day-date calendar record of every place I've been and everybody I've met with for the last 8 months. I had a TV pilot for which I was supposed to get paid $5,000 in the first initial payment the end of June. I've been blacklisted. The pilot's been scrapped. Any lawyer will be glad to help me if I can come up with a $10,000 retainer. Those of you who know me know that I have trouble eating on a daily basis because, my car has been repossessed and I've been through a lot of financial difficulties. Celerino Castillo has been in a traffic accident which may have been staged. Another witness, D. Caron Ferdinand in New Mexico, raises horses. All of our horses were turned loose 2 weeks ago in New Mexico and almost killed by trucks on the interstate. Chip Tatum, many of you have read the Tatum Chronicles, has had his phone shut off several times. The pressure is on the witnesses. Okay. So that's a sign that something is going on anyway. Now, we don't know what's going to happen. We absolutely do not know whether there's going to be hearings or not. Something is compelled to happen. And as Mike was talking to you before, earlier, President Clinton came back with this wonderful suggestion of reducing the disparity in cocaine sentencing for crack cocaine from 100 to 1 to 10 to 1. And Maxine Waters was absolutely eloquent when she took the House floor and said a tenth of slavery is not any better than 100% of slavery. She really rebuffed the president heavily and said, no, I want parity. The chips are being played behind the scenes. He wants to, my read and sources inside the government, the CIA, tell me that he's trying to trade all of these hearings for parity. If she gets that, that's going to be great, but I'm not so sure that she will. Okay? And also, those of us who have put our whole lives into this would like to get something, at least a chance to testify about our suffering as well. Okay? But shortly after she rebuffed him, I caught this little piece on MSNBC. And it was kind of a sidebar to the fundraising scandal. And the sidebar was how President Clinton was ready to appoint six new ambassadors to very wealthy Democratic contributors, including named six countries, one of which was the Bahamas. Maxine Waters' husband is the ambassador to the Bahamas. If Clinton is going to appoint a new ambassador to the Bahamas, he's going to have to fire Maxine's husband, isn't he? So, they're playing the heavy stakes poker right now. That's my read on it, and many people agree with me. Now, what we're going to do is I'm going to tell you in about an hour's worth of time the basics of my story and what my evidence is. And then we're going to throw it open to questions. And during the course of this, I will cover some of the other bits of evidence that are out there. But don't be deluded for a minute to think there isn't evidence to prove it. It's just like with the major other cases out here that people talk about. Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King. There's a ton of evidence. We all know it. It's there. It's just never been admitted. So don't delude yourselves for a second. Okay. Where we go with this is going to have to be determined by a collective will, by people working together, and by some kind of group conscience forming a path. Okay? But we can't stay silent. All right, before I start with the overlays. Yes?
Is there any hope at all that with this trade-off with Maxine and Clinton that the drug trafficking by the CIA will stop?
No, I don't see that at all. First thing, one of the first things you have to understand is that in the United States, we spend $49 billion a year on illegal drugs. That is more money per year than is spent on clothing, on housing, and on food in this country. That's directly from General Goofy McCaffrey, you know, the drug czar, okay, what I call it. The world spends $1.5 trillion a year on illegal narcotics. That's cash that flows through banks. It's an unmeasured part of the gross national product. And we all, whether we know it or not, or like it or not, benefit from it. How does that happen? If $200 million a month extra flows through the Federal Reserve Bank in Los Angeles, which is now regarded as the money laundering capital of the country, that $200 million lowers interest rates on loans that are charged to businesses. Businesses get loans cheaper, which generates more tax revenue, which pays municipal bonds. Do you get the picture? You can't play with $49 billion a year and not be talking about a significant part of the nation's economy. Okay. And come to think of it another way, does the auto industry have a lobby in Washington? Yes. Does the food industry, the housing industry, does any industry you can think of have a lobby in Washington? Yes. Isn't it stupid to think that the drug industry doesn't?
It's the banking lobby, isn't it?
Well, more or less, yes. I lived in Washington for a year and a half, from 1994 to 95, and I met with a number of congressional staffers and some congressmen, and I was told about, I couldn't see it, a classified report from the House Banking Committee chaired by Henry Gonzalez, which says that the six largest banks in the country would fail if the drug money was withdrawn. That's the kind of money we're talking about. That's the kind of power we're talking about. But the corruption is out of hand. The corruption is like a drunk on a bender. A guy can't be satisfied having six drinks. If he's a genuine blown alcoholic, he ain't going to be satisfied until he's passed out cold in the gutter. That's the way the disease works. How much is a little corruption? How much is enough? Since when does anybody ever stop after just making $10 million when he thinks, well, I'll quit when I get 15 or 100, et cetera, et cetera? That's the kind of process that we're dealing with. That's why it's so intractable. That's why it's so difficult. CIA has been dealing drugs since before it was CIA.
What?
Let's go back to the Second World War. And I'll do this briefly. The Second World War, we sprang Vito Genovese from prison in New York with the help of Lucky Luciano, who was capo di tutti capi, the Don of Dons. Okay. We wanted help protecting the New York docks from Nazi saboteurs. And we sent Vito Genovese to Sicily when we invaded Sicily. He helped George Patton make his way to Messina. We sent Vito Genovese up in Italy as we began to occupy Italy. And General Vesey, with the U.S. government's help and the help of the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, began to revitalize a narcotics trade which was almost dead. The heroin addict population in this country during the first years of World War II was down to nothing. Zero. I mean, it was, you know, marginal. By 46, 47, it was back up to pre-war levels. Immediately after the war, with the Mafia's help and the OSS's help, the OSS was extremely concerned about communist movements in France and Italy. We turned the Mafia loose, the Corsican Mafia and the Sicilian Mafia loose in southern France and in Italy. They began to fund their operations using heroin, which was refined in the infamous heroin labs of Marseille. That money in turn funded the anti-communist propaganda efforts, the strike breakers, the union breakers. Okay, so that's 45, 46, 47. And we move into Southeast Asia after Chiang Kai-shek was kicked out of China. His troops fled into Burma. We sent in very infamous people like Paul Helliwell, John Singlaub, whose name turns up still in Iran-Contra, a great many other CIA, OSS, Office of Policy Coordination hands went to Southeast Asia, and Paul Helliwell, a banker who bought all the land for Disney World, by the way, on behalf of the Disney Corporation, was paying the Kuomintang troops with sticky bars of heroin. That was the forerunner of all the heroin coming out of the Golden Triangle during the Vietnam War. I won't have time to give you the whole history, but it runs sequentially through every major area of covert operations that CIA has been involved in since its inception in 1947. Southeast Asia, Indochina with the French, there was actually a little war at one time between CIA and the French Deuxième Bureau in Indochina over who would control a lot of the opium trade. The French were running it directly also. When the French got kicked out at the Dien Bien Phu, CIA was already moving in to control the heroin trade in Southeast Asia. By the time, of course, we had the Vietnam War, it's legendary what we were doing in Laos. Ted Shackley, the station chief in Laos, who was a prominent figure in all of my work, was funding the whole war in Laos with heroin out of the Golden Triangle. It got so bad or so blatant that Air Vice Marshal Nguyen Cao Ky, in his battle with President Diem in 1970, was shut off from access to the outside world. So CIA, on his behalf, invaded Cambodia for a number of reasons. But one was to give Air Vice Marshal Ky access to small airstrips inside Cambodia where he could fly in, land his planes, and get all the heroin being brought out of the Golden Triangle. He couldn't get it out of the country of Vietnam, so he flew it back into South Vietnam, and to whom did he sell it? American GIs. The great heroin epidemic of 1970 amongst American GIs in South Vietnam. Direct participation of CIA. Every covert operation, every area of involvement, you find the same people with CIA. All the way through Southeast Asia, from Cuba, which is where Ted Shackley and Tom Clines and Ed Wilson and all the famous guys from Iran-Contra got their starts. Through Southeast Asia, through Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, remember the Russian invasion of Afghanistan? In 1979, 0% of U.S. heroin came from Pakistan. 79, the Russians invade Afghanistan. We set up a major support effort in Pakistan. And now the heroin poppy grows in the mountains between 5,000 and 6,000 feet where it's happiest. Lots of mountains in Pakistan and Afghanistan. By 1982, 45% of the heroin in this country was coming from Pakistan, directly correlated to CIA operations. So we get to Iran-Contra, and it's no big deal, except for this time all the brakes were off. And we find the same players we found throughout history. Richard Secord, Ted Shackley, Tom Clines, George Bush, Felix Rodriguez. Okay, I'll give you a punchline about Felix toward the end of the talk tonight. The same players are always turning up in the same places, and the MO is always the same. Okay. How did I get involved in this? Bad karma. Really bad karma. That's, I don't know what else to say. I come from a family very steeped in intelligence. My mother had been a cryptographer at Fort Myer, Virginia during the Second World War for Army intelligence. My father was an Air Force officer, a pilot, flyer. Flew during the Korean War, got out of the Air Force, went to work for Martin Marietta, which built the Titan IIIC rockets, which put up all of the keyhole satellites for the agency. Relatives of my father had been OSS during the Second World War, my father's cousins, and Sam and Barbara both retired from the agency in the mid-80s after like 25, 30 years. So I come from a spook family. I was born in Washington, D.C. I was an only child. I was an honor student. raised a devout conservative Republican. I'm a recovering Republican, so don't hold it against me. Went to UCLA and was an honor student at UCLA, and I started interning for LAPD in 1969 when I was a freshman at UCLA. Now, my closest friend for 4 years at UCLA was a guy by the name of Craig Fuller. Craig and I were the only two living Republicans on the UCLA campus from 1969 to 1973. Craig became George Bush's chief of staff during Iraq-Contra. I was chosen to intern for Chief Ed Davis at LAPD in 1970, at exactly the same time Craig Fuller was chosen to intern for Governor Ronald Reagan. We were being groomed from very early ages for positions of power within the establishment. I was all for it. I worked at four or five divisions, but I spent about a year and a half in the chief's office at LAPD. I left as a student worker. That was what the position was called after I turned 21. I hadn't graduated yet, so I finished college, joined the LAPD in 1973, was valedictorian of my cadet class, and went to work in Wilshire Division, a place called the Jungle, down near Crenshaw and Martin Luther King. That's when Wilshire Division had the Jungle. It's part of Southwest now. And worked the streets there, and then went into narcotics very quickly, and I was being groomed. A little sidebar here. My first captain at LAPD when I was an intern was Captain Archie Bob Sillings, who had been the lieutenant watch commander at Rampart Division the night Bobby Kennedy was shot, moving people around. Two lieutenants at Venice Division, Tudor and Tackleberry, or Sergeant Tudor and Lieutenant Tackleberry, had been Metro, who had been at Central Receiving Hospital when Bobby Kennedy arrived. When I was drawn to the chief's office, my first commendation was written by Sergeant Dave Brath, who had been the chief scribe for Special Unit Senator, which wrote the RFK investigation for LAPD. Commander Carol Kirby assigned me in the chief's office. He had been captain of communications division at LAPD the night Bobby Kennedy was shot, and he showed up at the Ambassador Hotel 20 minutes after the shooting, right when there was a radio blackout, which blocked descriptions other than Sirhan being put out. When I was with LAPD and working with organized crime intelligence, I wound up working with the man who had been Ethel Kennedy's bodyguard the night Bobby Kennedy was shot. There's a pattern here that I'm trying to get to. When I graduated from UCLA, I was flown back to Washington, D.C. by my family, and I was told it was to be given a recruitment pitch by CIA. Now, I wasn't a cop yet. I was just ready to graduate with honors, you know, Dean's List, you know, magna cum laude, and all this stuff. And I was taken into the old executive office building right next to the White House, and a big guy with a CIA seal behind his head had all my package, knew everything about me, you know, and everything there, and said, Mike, the agency loves you. We want you to go to work for us. What we would like for you to do is to join the agency, become a case officer, and we will put you back undercover through the L.A. Police Academy, and being an L.A. cop will be your cover. That's illegal. Okay. I went through the interview, I took a stack of papers about that thick, which were to fill out for my clearances, and I never sent them back. That was the end of it for me. I didn't want to do it. I just wanted to come out here to be a cop, drive fast, have fun, meet lots of pretty women, carry a gun, and just do the things that a young college graduate white guy would do being a cop. But I really wanted to put bad guys in jail. That was what that's what I wanted to do. Well, after I'm on LAPD, loaned to narcotics a couple of times. I was loaned into burglary and the homicide at Wilshire Division. And being groomed, I meet and fall in love with a woman who turns out to be working for CIA. She had grown up with the niece of the Shah of Iran, Minu Hagstrom, who was the daughter of Ashraf, the Shah's twin sister. She knew mafia people like Carlo Costello in New Orleans and Carlo Gambino. She also knew key high-ranking LAPD people like Lee Goforth, senior detective at Organized Crime Intelligence Division, who had been Ethel Kennedy's bodyguard the night Bobby was shot. Lee was also a brigadier general in the California National Guard. Direct military connection there, and CIA connection. And I was deeply in love. And, you know, so she said, well, my people are interested in having you go to work for us. They can make your career. And I was all for it. I was in love. I had her. You know, I was promoting like a rocket ship in LAPD. But then she started talking about being in places and seeing 50 kilos of cocaine and like 1,000 M16s. Now, having worked narcotics, and I was already a narcotics expert. I had done two extended loans, and when I got promoted to detective, I was going back to narcotics. I said, man, 50, geez, if, you know, that was a lot of coke in 1976. You know, nobody really knew what cocaine was then. It was just coming on the scene. It really hadn't been. You know, and she said, our people, my people, aren't interested in the drugs. And I said, are you crazy? I said, if I'm ever in a room with 50 kilos of cocaine, somebody's going to jail. And it's not going to be me, you know? But the stories would come, and they would come in Hawaii, where she was in Hawaii and saw the guns going out and the drugs coming in. It happened in Baja California in several places. It happened in Del Rio, Texas. It happened especially in New Orleans. It happened in the Bahamas. And over time, even though I was really enamored with the fact that she was getting letters and phone calls from Tehran all the time, that the Shah's nephew would come and pick her up and take her out for dinner, that she had all this information out of my personnel package, that she knew that Daryl Gates was going to be the next chief of police, that she knew that the LAPD intelligence captains were going to retire and where they were going to go to work afterwards, I began to get the picture that there was something really wrong with the drugs, and I kept saying, I will not get involved with anything that overlooks drugs. I can't. I'm a cop, and I'm an honest cop, and I'm not going to break that. Well, she disappeared in 1977. Said somebody was trying to kill her, and it took me about 5 or 6 months, during which time I wound up being loaned, I was on staff at the academy then, to organize crime intelligence division, and getting shot at and followed and threatened and hang up phone calls, and I'm loaned into organized crime intelligence working with Lee Goforth and Norm Bonneau, and they're asking me all these questions about Teddy, and I'm keeping my mouth shut. That was her name, Teddy. And eventually, I was burglarized and my gun was stolen, and photos of her were taken. I thought, my God, they're going to kill her. So my captain, Jesse Brewer, who you may recall was our beloved police commissioner here just after the riots, the black police commissioner who should have been chief of police, just arranged my a vacation for me. He was my captain at the time. I went to New Orleans where I had found Teddy. And over the course of 8 days, I saw and met people. Now, I saw her arranging. She had a scrambler phone in her apartment, which I later described to an Air Force officer and said, that's a KY-3. It's top secret. You couldn't even have described it unless you'd seen it. She had a black night vision device. She was meeting with personnel working for a company known as Brown & Root, a major CIA contractor, which is sheep-dipped CIA personnel into it, heavy contributors to Nixon and LBJ. People on ships owned by Brown & Root were taking guns to Iran to give to the Kurds. And Kurdistan in Iran is the second largest opium growing region in the world. She was meeting with former Special Forces personnel. She was arranging also for quantities of heroin to be dropped off on oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. And the reason why they did that was because international ships can stop at oil rigs in international waters, take off the heroin, which bubbleheads, those are deep sea divers, would take and put down on the pilings underwater. And then service boats would sail out from New Orleans to service the oil rigs, not subject to customs search, go down and service the rigs, retrieve the heroin, and take it right back into New Orleans. All arranged courtesy of Don Carlos Marcello in New Orleans and the CIA. So over the course of 8 days, I saw all the key players. I saw her receive communication from Naval and Air Force personnel assigned to Belchase Naval Air Station. I heard her on the phone arranging for shipments of guns to be moved to certain docks at certain times. I heard her on the phone talking about picking up certain packages from certain oil rigs and bringing it in. All of that is direct, admissible testimony from me in a court of law, because from her position, it was testimony against her interest. Okay? I heard that. I saw that.
Penal interest.
Penal interest, yes. Yeah. In other words, she was basically talking about criminal stuff in my presence. Okay? That's the bottom line. I saw these people. One time I followed her down to some docks and I saw her watching a ship in some bushes. That was the second time. That was the first time I was really shot at directly. Okay? But that's all admissible evidence. Now, I was forced out of LAPD the end of 1978. I don't know how long I've been going. Well, I'm going to try to speed through this. Let me turn the switch.
Did your romance with her continue till then?
No. It ended in New Orleans. I said, I'm out of here. This is done. July 7, 20 years ago, last month. Ended. Okay? I said, I'm out of here. Leave me alone. I don't want to know anymore. I don't want to see anymore. I'm done. All right, now I knew that my department was lying. I was forced out December 78, after the Iranian Revolution had started. And I had a tape-recorded death threat. Now I knew that And I asked to see Chief Gates, because the guys in OCID were lying to me. The guys in organized crime intelligence I knew were CIA. There were three guys there I knew. Lee Goforth, Norm Bonneau, and a guy named John Xavier Vach. Vach was Daryl Gates' first driver bodyguard. A CIA man. Daryl Gates' first driver bodyguard. When I resigned with a tape-recorded death threat, I had an attorney, and I was smart enough and lucky enough to have planted doomsday packages in case I turned up dead. Documents were going to get mailed. People were going to get called, et cetera, et cetera. This letter went to not only Sam Hayakawa, it went to Tom Bradley, Alan Cranston, Bob Dornan, and Anthony Bielenson. Okay? Now it says until Thursday, et cetera, et cetera. But notice what I say here. Two investigators from organized crime intelligence of LAPD, Lee Goforth, Charles Norman Bonneau, Nordica Theodora Dorsey, okay, of the Central Intelligence Agency, grew up with the niece of the Shah of Iran, Daryl Gates, Chief of Police. And then, in here, in the second page of that letter, that was dated December 6th, 78, we're talking about CIA, Brown and Root, LAPD files, intelligence personnel, Carlos Marcello, the mafia figures, Dan Horowitz, Hank Friedman, intimidation, okay, so on and so forth. Large quantities of cocaine and firearms in Hawaii, Mexico, the Bahamas, and New Orleans. That's the key part I want you to remember about this letter. Okay? The response from LAPD and the FBI was that I was insane. I was delusional. I was a mental defective. I should never have been hired into LAPD, and I was totally nuts. Okay? My attorney stuck with me. I eventually went to the LA Times. And then about a year later, something really rare happened. The American press did something good. Now, this is by a writer named Tom Renner of Newsday. This was November 1579, almost a year exactly after I resigned. This was an 8-page article. Guns for drugs trade booming, reports disclose. Millions of dollars worth of weapons are being smuggled into Mexico, South America, Lebanon, so on and so forth. And what does it say in here? It says that primarily this is being run by Carlos Marcello in New Orleans, that the shipments are happening out of New Orleans, Baja California, that places Teddy had already named, and that I had named the year before. Guns going one way, drugs going the other, both cocaine and heroin, some going to terrorist groups, some going to armed factions like the Kurds. Over 8 pages, this is a replay of the letter I wrote a year before. Okay? So if I'm crazy, I'm also a prophet. Okay? What happened when this came out was, I finally understood in depth that CIA was actually dealing the drugs. They weren't letting somebody do it. They weren't slightly profiting from it. They were arranging it. They were getting the money. They were running and staging and coordinating geopolitical operations through the use of drug money. And the drugs were sold to Americans in this country. I picked up the phone and called Tom Renner. I said, Tom, CIA is dealing drugs. And Tom says, you're absolutely right. He says, you need to talk to a Senate investigator by the name of Bill Christensen. So I called Bill Christensen, working at the time for Senator Dennis DeConcini on the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Improvements in Judicial Machinery. There's a mouthful. And I called Bill Christensen, and Bill Christensen, a Senate investigator, says, Mike, I don't know what to do. My phones are tapped. I'm being burglarized. I've followed to and from work. My files are disappearing. Now, what this story had said was that DEA had this really secret report about all these operations of guns for drugs. And this story, Tom Renner said, also that an unnamed federal agency was sanitizing all the DIA files and stealing all of the reports linking the organized crime people to the drug trafficking. That was CIA. So I laid everything else I knew to Bill Christensen, and Christensen said, Mike, we've got to get you back here to testify. Hi. And that was the second time I was shot at. Not only did the hearings never take place, I couldn't find a job anywhere in the city of Los Angeles. Anywhere. I wound up working at a 7-Eleven store on Robertson. My second day on the job, I'm arrested by West LA Vice for drug liquor to a minor. I had to file bankruptcy a month later. Obviously, I'm onto something here. Now, what did I find out at this? Well, we're going to get to that in a minute. This is just some of the documentary evidence. You can see the date very clearly.
4/18/1980, Federal Bureau of Investigation. I got this back through a Freedom of Information Act request. You don't have to read the whole thing, but notice the where the check marks are. Rupert advised because of Teddy Dorsey's association with Carlos Marcello and a claim to be a government agent, CIA and DEA are in conspiracy with other law enforcement agencies and are allowing the Mafia to smuggle guns to friendly rebel groups and to smuggle drugs back into the country as payment for the guns. CIA dealing drugs, 1980. Okay, I've been saying this for a long time before Gary Weber ever got a newspaper story. Okay, unfortunately, a lot of us who have been at this for a while knew exactly what was going to happen to Gary Weber. I had mentioned Craig Fuller being my closest friend through 4 years at UCLA. I'm going to slide over and get my drink. I don't know if you can read that. Craig Fuller, in the first Reagan term, was assistant to President Reagan for Cabinet Affairs. He worked directly under Ed Meese. The Herald Examiner ran stories on me. This kind of proves that I know Craig. The original of this letter was stolen from my residence 3 days after I confronted John Deutsch in Watts. There are 6 or 7 letters, and I still have other originals. But the original of this letter was stolen November 18, 1996, the same day that the Senate Select Intelligence Committee called me and asked me if I had original letters on White House stationery. They were stolen that night. Okay? All right. Clearly a personal letter, wouldn't you agree? Okay. The Herald Examiner ran stories on me October 11th and October 18th, 1981. Randall Sullivan, the date's up there, but this is the first part of the story. That's the front page of the Sunday edition. It starts there. It says continued on the back page. I got the whole back page. Not one Sunday, but 2 Sundays in a row. I love this. This says that Michael Rupert, that's me, was perhaps LAPD's most intelligent officer. Can't you see it for all the money I have? Okay. So through all of this intrigue and all of this, that's a very bad picture of Teddy. She was gorgeous. I mean, she was enough to make the most intelligent man really stupid. The second part of the story, the following Sunday, starts down here. And finally, down here, the second part, and it's really out of focus, don't even try to read it, it finally talks about CIA dealing drugs. But God bless them, you know, the Herald Examiner actually said it. Now, I've written as a writer for the LA Times. I have known that David Rosenzweig, who was the assistant managing editor, for 18 years. They've never printed a word about my story. But every time I get information on CIA and gave it to Dave Rosenzweig, who was a reporter when I met him, he got promoted. I have that effect on people. Okay? All right, so, I'm going to turn this off for a minute, because I want to say a couple things really important.
Can I get it?
Thank you. I was flown back again to Washington in October of 1981. I carried part two of the Herald Examiner under my arm. On October 26, 1981, Craig Fuller, whose letter you just saw, let me into the White House, the West Wing. I sat in his office directly under Ronald Reagan's butt. Actually, Ronald was at the other side of the West Wing, but you know, I was there. And I looked at Craig, and I talked to him, and we caught up on the personal stuff. And again, my awakening was very slow. I didn't realize. Now, you got to understand that what I saw was happening under a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter. Okay, it makes no difference who occupies the White House. Disabuse yourself of any such illusion. There are no two political parties in this country. And I sat there looking at Craig, and we talked, and I said to him finally, Craig, CIA is complicit in bringing drugs into this country, and it's wrong. He turned into a statue. He didn't move. He didn't blink. He didn't nod. He didn't wink. He didn't grunt. He didn't burp. He didn't do anything until I changed the subject. So we had a talk, and that was it. I left the White House, and I remember walking out of the White House and saying, where do I go now? And I waited around, and I went to Hayakawa's office, and I went to see Dornan. Sam Hayakawa, the Republican, the former president of San Jose State, or San Francisco State, was actually a wonderfully kind gentleman. He helped me quite a bit. Nobody else did. And after a week of bashing around Washington, finding that nobody wanted to hear a damn thing I had to say,
This is October of 81. Oliver North was just getting warmed up here, folks. I mean, Ollie was just really starting to get into the game. I picked up the phone and I called the managing editor of the Washington Star, and I got right through. I'm ex-LAPD narc. I'm friends with Craig Fuller, who's now in the White House. I just left the White House. Wham! I laid it all out to the managing editor of the Washington Star, and I said, CIA's dealing drugs. And he says, Mike, that's the worst kept secret in Washington. They all know it. They all know it. They've all, always, all known it. Okay? So I came back to California. In January of 82, I did the only thing I knew how to do. I went back to my alma mater, UCLA, and I found out the ranking political science expert of the Middle East on UCLA. Notice where he's working now, by the way. Bankers Trust. Okay. I saw Paul Jaber, formerly associate professor of political science, University of California, Los Angeles. I go into his office and I start telling him my story. He says, Mike, did you know, by the way, that I was a CIA and State Department consultant in the Carter administration on the National Security Council? I said, no. I said, oh. He said, well, listen, I have all these secrecy oaths. And I can't tell you directly what you want to know, but I got to tell you, you're really on the money. But here's what I suggest you do. He whipped out a pen and he wrote down some dates and he said, go look up these articles on these dates by William Sapphire of the New York Times and C.L. Schultzberger. Okay? Go back and read them and tell me what you find. So I went and dug up the articles and I found it and I came back to him. And this is what he said I was absolutely right on. In 1975, for years before that, we had been arming the Kurds, who live in Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. They really don't have a country of their own. To fight against Saddam Hussein, who had just taken over Iraq in 1975. But we've been arming the Kurds to fight against Iraq. Why? So that Iraq's army couldn't attack Israel. Real simple. It was just part of our balance of power strategy with Israel to keep all the Arab armies divided. March 3rd, 75, the Shah of Iran and Saddam Hussein cut a deal. And the deal is the Treaty of Algiers. And then the Shah says, Saddam, I'll give you the Shah al-Arab waterway. Saddam gave the Shah the Shah al-Arab waterway, and the Shah cut off all the American aid to the Kurds. So Saddam could kill all the Kurds. March 3rd, 75. The only way in and out of Kurdistan was through opium smuggling routes. The Kurds had been a CIA asset since the Second World War. So a decision was made at the National Security Council level, and you can't say CIA and drugs really without saying NSC. A decision was made to arm the Kurds with heroin that would be sold in the United States. The NSC is the White House. What happened? Ted Shackley, station chief in Laos and station chief in Saigon, was promoted to deputy director of covert operations at CIA. Took over the covert side. Richard Secord was transferred out of Vietnam to become the air attaché to the Shah of Iran. Richard Armitage, a key player, was made a defense attaché in Iran. The same players from Iran-Contra went from Southeast Asia directly to work for the Shah at the same time that we started bringing in Kurdish heroin into New Orleans in 1975. And that was ongoing, and that's what I saw in 1977. He said, you're absolutely right. That decision was a policy decision made at the NSC at the White House. Evidence. He said it to me. Admission against interest. I'll save the map on the Middle East because we're running short of time. Oh, okay. Also evidence. See that thing officers moonlighting probed? Now the date there is 1985. Or 1984, November 17th, talks about an LAPD officer assigned to Organized Crime Intelligence Division who has been charged with moonlighting on city time and selling secrets and doing things with his city car while he's getting a city paycheck that are illegal. The guy's name is John Xavier Bach. That was Daryl Gates' driver bodyguard, who I said was CIA when they forced me out of LAPD and they called me crazy. Well, in this LA Times story about John Xavier Bach, it says that Bach was selling his stuff to a guy named Rapaski, who turned over the transcript of all the bugging that Bach had done to an employee of the Central Intelligence Agency. John Bach was convicted of moonlighting for the Central Intelligence Agency on city time. Evidence.